Spring into action with the biggest fly fishing gear sale of the season. Jackson Hole Fly Company is thrilled to announce their spectacular 25% off anniversary sale. They are inviting all of us to celebrate with them. Whether you're a seasoned angler or just starting out, there's never been a better time to upgrade your equipment and save big. Are you looking for a rugged, waterproof sling pack or backpack to keep your gear dry throughout all the adventures this year? They have you covered. Are you in search of a new carbon fiber landing net? Top quality fly boxes, essential gear like fly lines and leaders? They have all that and more. This is your chance to grab some incredible deals and make the fishing season unforgettable. Don't wait. Dive into the savings today. Head over to jacksonholeflycompany.com and take advantage of this limited time sale.
I learned very soon that it's very good to talk to clients before they make a purchase. Make certain that it's going to be a comfortable purchase for them. And I don't want to be in the shopping cart mode in which people buy something and get it and think, holy cow, you know, I ordered that online after I'd had four martinis, and that may not have been a good choice for me.
That was Ward Tonsfeldt with a lesson he learned early on in his business. We are going old school today on the Wet Fly Swing Fly Fishing Show.
Welcome to the Wet Fly Swing Fly Fishing Show, where you discover tips, tricks, and tools from the leading names in fly fishing today.
Hey, how's it going today? Thanks for stopping by the Fly Fishing Show. Please take a quick moment and share this episode out if you know somebody who maybe has an old fly rod or maybe is looking for a cool classic custom rod or reel today that would love this. Today we're going to find out why this is such a cool topic to dig into if you haven't thought much about it today. So we're going to shed some light for you on that. Click that share button. Help us out. Help the community out. Help us find one more person today. Ward Tonsfeldt is here to share some tips on finding a high-quality classic fly rod. We find out what makes a classic rod classic, where to go to value your rod, and a classic rod and reel combo for less than $1,000. Actually, quite a bit less. This is a cool outfit that is totally reasonable. So this today is the guide you've been looking for. Without further ado, here is Ward Tonsfeldt from ClassicFlyFishingTackle.com. How's it going, Ward?
Very well, Dave. Thank you.
Yeah, thanks for putting some time together today to get this episode out. We're going to dig into, you've got a website that pops up a lot when you type in classic fly fishing and, you know, any of those words around classic gear, and you've got a good resource there. We're going to talk about that website and what you have going. But take us back to fly fishing, kind of how you first got, give us a story. How did you get into fly fishing?
Well, my father was a keen fly fisherman. I grew up in Portland, Oregon, and we fished a lot. On the coast, in the coastal streams, and also east of the mountains, especially the upper end of the Deschutes. So when I grew up, although there's debatable that I've actually grown up, we moved over to Bend and still fish the same areas.
Nice. So you're in Bend currently?
Yes.
Oh, good. Okay. Yeah. And are you, as far as your fly fishing, are you focused mostly on like just trout fishing or lakes or rivers?
Yeah, I fish trout mostly, and the upper end of the Deschutes has lakes and a few rivers. I also fish a lot in the Williamson and the Crooked, Mutolius, pretty much what you'd expect. On the coast, I fish the Siletz and some of the streams north of there. The last few years, been fishing the Alsea a little bit more, and I enjoy that. I'm serious about sea run cutthroat, and not always successful, but always serious. And I also fish southeastern Alaska, usually in August and September.
What's the, and this is good. I mean, there's a few questions I have there on, I'd love to chat a little bit about sea runs, but, you know, getting started here just on kind of the gear, you know, the classic fly fish, how did that all come to be? How'd you get into creating a website for that?
Well, about 25 years ago, a bunch of guys that I knew around the country, we decided to get a website and, you know, get a chance to get stuff and sell stuff. And that worked out pretty well. Over the years, the number of people in the group has fluctuated, but we still keep together. And I've sort of gotten myself into the position of doing most of the management and activity on the website. Our first website was a very simple one. My daughter, who was in high school at the time, put it together for us, and it worked. As the web commerce has become more sophisticated in recent years, I've gotten an updated website, and that's working out pretty well for me. So I use that and try to keep up with new stuff coming in all the time.
So, yeah, I mean, I want to just get started off here just on, there's a few different words when people are out there kind of looking for the gear. And I have a few questions about the types of gear, you know, and some of the stuff out there. But talk about vintage, classic, antique, all, kind of some of those names that you pop out. Are they all kind of the same, or what makes a fly rod or fly reel or whatever vintage?
Well, I take vintage as something that's older, that's perhaps no longer made. I take antique as something that's probably 19th century, that goes back quite a ways. And classic, for our purposes, I think, refers to something that's been around for a long time, that continues to be relevant in terms of what people use, and that is pleasing. So, for example, a very good example of a classic reel would be a Hardy Perfect. They were first made in the 1890s, and they're still being made.
That is cool. That is a great example, because you hear a lot about the Hardy for sure. And so is that reel, the ones that are made today, how similar is that reel to the ones that were made 100 years ago?
Obviously, there are some mechanical changes, relatively minor. There's also some changes in fabrication, not a lot of changes in terms of design. The finish has changed over the years, but the basic logic of the reel, it remains the same.
Okay. Do you deal more with, I mean, I know your website's got classic in the title, but do you deal with more classic gear or more vintage, or what do you, you know, what's your majority of the work you...
The term classic is really important because, you know, we don't sell a lot of stuff to collectors who are interested in antique items or items that are interesting because they're simply old. So we're interested in stuff that, you know, is useful. All of our clients want to fish the items that they have. They may not fish them, but they want to be able to fish them. So a reel that is, for example, the old British brass fly reels, you see a lot of them around, they're attractive, they're interesting, and they're also pretty much useless. And that's not the kind of thing we do. If we do something that's old, you know, maybe pre-turn of the 20th century, like a very early Hardy Perfect, it would be one that is functional, that's working, that's fishable. Although the price of the early Perfects is such, so you probably wouldn't want to fish it.
What would you be paying for a good quality that reel?
A brass face Perfect these days is going to run you somewhere in excess of $2,000.
Okay.
So, you know, I mean, that's not unreasonably expensive for a reel, but there are probably other Perfects that are equally fishable and are available at a less intimidating price.
Gotcha. Okay. So basically your website, maybe you could just kind of start there as far as your website. If somebody is coming in and it sounds like they're not necessarily your target client isn't necessarily like a collector. It's more of the person who wants, like you said, use the gear. So is that true?
Exactly. Yeah. The person who wants to be able to use the gear. If the person doesn't actually use it, that's none of our business. But all of our clients expect the gear to be working, workable, and also, you know, good stuff, as opposed to something that, you know, that may have been an interesting idea at the time, but has not worked out very well over the years. Now, let me give you an example. There was a time in the 1920s when steel fly rods were extremely fashionable. Yeah. Okay. You've probably seen one. And I would say that a steel fly rod might be a piece of vintage tackle, or it might be a piece of antique tackle. But since the steel fly rods were not very successful and people do not enjoy using them, they're probably not what we would consider classic, if that makes sense to you.
Yeah, it does. So, but yeah, classic is just, like you said, classic is stuff people are going to be potentially using still today pretty commonly.
Exactly.
Okay. What is a, you know, as far as going back to that gear, you know, what they'd be using typically? I mean, who is your, you know, that target? Who is that client typically? Do you know who that person is that is coming to your site?
Well, sure. I know a lot of them. And we've kept up relationships over the years, getting stuff, going back and forth with stuff. I recently sold, a few days ago, a rod to a client in Japan. He's a international fisherman. He fishes in the U.S., in Europe, and also in Japan. And he enjoys trout fishing. He likes the lighter rods. I had a Orvis Deluxe, which is a nice rod from the 1950s that he purchased. He told me that he took it out on the upper end of the Sumida River, and that he was very pleased with the way it worked. And that's probably, you know, not our typical client, but is someone who we've had a relationship with over the years and who's enjoyed our products.
That's cool. That's a cool story. What about have you seen many of the Orvis Rivermasters come through there?
I'm not familiar with the Rivermasters. We sell a lot of Orvis bamboo rods and the occasional Orvis graphite or fiberglass rod. Our emphasis is sort of on the higher end bamboo rods and, the reels.
Oh, okay. Yeah. So the bamboo is a focus for you. So that, I'm glad you mentioned that, because bamboo is always, has kind of been a little bit of interest to me, and I don't know a lot about it, but you know, a lot of people I know have bamboo rods, right? They got stuff, collected from a garage sale or something. How does somebody know if they get a bamboo rod, or if they have one right now sitting in their den or something? How would they get a feel for what that thing is worth? What would you recommend they do if they just want to find out if it's the value?
Well, the easy way is to just go on eBay and on the sold listings and see what similar rods have been selling for. With bamboo rods, the condition is critically important. So again, the rod needs to be something that can fish. The ferrules need to be good. The cane needs to be good. And also, obviously, there are makers that are more desirable than others.
Okay, perfect. So on the bamboo rods, let's just take a dive down that for a little bit. So what is the, you know, I guess there's all sorts of different levels of rods, but what are a typical rod that comes through that you are, you know, the clients are looking for?
Right now, they're looking for rods that were made by Bob Taylor, and I sold the last one that I had a couple months ago, and I wish I had more. Taylor was one of the men who worked in the Leonard shop before it went out of business in the 80s. He was continued making rods after that, very successful rods, very similar to Leonard's. Tapers are similar. The workmanship is similar, and the cane treatment is similar. And very nice, beautifully finished rods, and they're kind of enjoying a spurt of popularity right now.
And that's just, and how does that happen? How does that become, get a spurt of popularity? Somebody, because it seems like I'd imagine there's a lot of different bamboo rods and companies that are not around anymore. How does that happen?
Well, I'm certain that...
maybe that's a tough question.
Yeah, I don't know exactly what the.
Yeah.
I mean, I know what my friends like, and you know, and we talk about certain rods, and we certainly go ahead and go after them and stuff like that. But I don't know what the genesis of the.
Yeah, what makes a Leonard, you know, special, like compared to any other rod of that time?
Well, the Leonard company was in business for a long time. Hiram Leonard made the first beveler, which is the machine that could make the equilateral triangle sections that are glued together to form the hexagonal rods. So Leonard didn't invent the bamboo rod, but he made it work. He made it popular, and his the continuity of the company was amazing. They were able to attract very talented rod makers, and they did that throughout their years. And they're probably their most successful rod was the Leonard Model 50, which is an 8-foot, 3-piece, 5-weight rod, which they started making around the time of World War I and continued through the 80s. So it was a long-lived rod. It had several variations, but I just recently got a Leonard 50, which was made sometime in the 60s, and I was amazed to see that it had exactly the same tapers as one of my earliest Model 50s. So it's a nice piece of continuity in rod history. A lot of people were influenced by Leonard, and their basic ideas for both the 3-piece and the 2-piece fly rods were, I think, are extremely influential in American rod making.
There you go. So that's they had a big impact. Are you still fishing? Do you fish a lot of the old gear? Is that mainly what you're fishing? Some of the older classic vintage stuff?
I fish bamboo on streams. I tend not to fish it in boats because they're kind of rough on the rods. And the rods that I fish are not older ones, they're generally newer ones. But a lot of them are similar. For example, I have some relatively new Leonards made by Thomas Maxwell that I like very much. He made rods through the end of the Leonard business in the early 1980s.
Okay.
That's a new rod for us.
That's a new rod. Yeah, okay. So that's it. So the 80s is a new rod. Yeah. If you're going to go out and put together a setup for trout, let's just say a typical setup, rod and reel, and I guess we haven't talked about lines yet, but what would you be going if money was no option, you just wanted to get the great setup, what would that be?
Well, two sort of interesting streams in my area, Fall River, which is a tributary of the Deschutes, a little bit south of Bend, and the Metolius, which is a major tributary of the Deschutes. For those two, which are sort of typical stream fishing, I generally fish an 8-foot rod, and I would probably choose a bamboo rod for those areas because they're easy to fish. There's a little bit of overhanging material on the Fall River, but you can keep yourself clean pretty easily there. And I would probably choose something in the 4-weight or 5-weight zone. Actually, since we're talking about Leonard 50s, a rod built on that basis or one of the 50s would be a good choice. As far as a reel goes, I would probably use a Hardy, probably one of the lightweight series, and probably a... Princess might be a good choice, depending on the rod and, sort of the way that it went together with the rod.
And then what about, do people look for classic lines and things like that as well? Maybe that's the extreme.
Yeah, I think that the idea of using an old silk line, some people have done that. It tends to be a little inconvenient, and it's maybe not such a good choice. There are new silk lines that are made, and people like those. I happen not to like them, so I generally buy whatever the fly shop has on sale that year.
All right, perfect. What about other gear? So we got fly. What other? It sounds like rods and reels are the big ones. Any other classic gear that comes through your website?
Oh, everyone has things they like to tinker with and like to keep on their vests. Fly boxes. I think the Wheatley fly boxes are lots of fun. They work well. And they're sort of timeless. I don't like the plastic fly boxes so much because they get scratched up and they're not so convenient. But I don't use the fly wallets, the leather wallets. They're maybe not so good on the flies as the boxes are. So I guess a Wheatley box would be something that I would certainly choose, and I sell a lot of them.
And what about the old Creel? This again is kind of throwing back, but I know that people love those Creels, not to use them necessarily, but
and I'm certainly a great fan of the Creels. They're not a practical fishing tool anymore. None of us keep trout, I have several creels. In fact, I'm looking across at one right now, and I think they're wonderful pieces of work, and I admire the ingenuity and the tradition that lies behind them, but I certainly don't take them out in the woods.
No. No. What's a creel? What's a good, like, what's a upper end classic creel cost or run on eBay?
The creel story is a complicated one. They were invented probably in Belgium sometime in the 17th century. They came into England and France and Germany from the Belgian basket weavers. As near as we can tell, the Scots were the first people to put leather on the creels. And the story is always that the Scots were so thrifty, they didn't want their creels to wear out, so they covered them with leather, which made them more durable. For our purposes in the U.S., there were creels made in the northeastern states, oftentimes of wooden splints, and those are called the woodland creels, and they are generally not leathered. On the West Coast, the leather workers around Portland, Oregon, which was a early center of the leather industries, got into making sporting goods as the market for harnesses and other kinds of horse gear diminished around the turn of the century. The Portland leather lofts, as they were called, produced a lot of creels. George Lawrence is probably the best known of the creel makers in Portland, but there are other excellent ones, and they're probably at the height in around 1920, there were probably 7 or 8 shops producing high quality creels. These were sold nationally through the retailers back east, like Van Lin Gerke and their shops, and Abercrombie and Fitch and other retailers. And the Portland creels have a very distinctive leathering pattern. You can always check them out. A good quality Lawrence these days is probably going to sell for around $500, and they were made up through the 50s. A high-end collectible creel is going to run a little bit more than that, but you probably can get anything you want for under $2,000, and chances are something that's really expensive is going to run around $1,000.
Okay. So there's not going to be a crew out there that's going to cost you, that's going to go for like a $50,000 or $100,000 or something like that. You're not seeing any of that stuff.
I think you're pretty safe on that, Dave.
Yeah. All right. Well, let's take it back to the rod, because it sounds like the rods is a bulk of what you do. If we were, you know, if somebody was coming in to look, they wanted to get, it sounds like the cool idea is, you know, that getting a connection to some of these classic, I'm thinking back to the person from Japan that bought that rod.
And, right.
And you wonder, okay, like, why would this person want this rod? Why not spend that money on a nice new bamboo rod or whatever it is, right? Or whatever type of rod. And you think it's mainly, I mean, why are these people buying the classic stuff? Is it just to connect a little bit to the older, or is there something else?
Well, there's some technical things. The Orbis rods, the tapers were designed by Wes Jordan, who was a kind of a seminal figure in the two-piece rod development, especially coming out of World War II. And his rods are very nice. They're fun to cast, and they're absolutely everybody loves them. The Orbis rods were impregnated with a early plastic substance that provided a very durable finish for them. So most bamboo rods are varnished, and the varnish can deteriorate, and it needs a little bit of upkeep and maintenance. And the impregnated finish that Orbis developed is, you know, absolutely solid, sort of forever. So they're fun rods to have in that regard. Some people don't like them. They think that the impregnation dampens down the action. But, you know, if you had two fly fishermen together in a room, there are at least 9 topics that they would disagree about. So I don't take that very seriously. I saw a lot of Orbises, as I said, and people are comfortable with them. They like them. They like to fish them. They feel good about them. The rod that my client in Japan chose was an Orbis Deluxe. There weren't very many of those made. They have some very distinctive characteristics. It was a rod design that Jordan himself worked on and perfected, and it has a certain feel to it that almost no other rod has. I can think of a few that are close, but the people who like the deluxes, and my client is one of those people, pretty much go after them. That's what they want. So, you know, it's a rod that wouldn't jump out at you if you were not, you know, if you didn't have a sort of a predilection for lightweight, faster bamboo rods. But once you discover them, then, as I said, they're distinct. And if you like them, that's what you want.
There you go. So it sounds like a lot of the people that you're working with are, you know, they're definitely more interested in just, you know, not only using the gear, but they're getting it because they feel like it's just more kind of resonates more with them than a brand new rod of like, right? Because you can go buy a new Orvis bamboo rod right now.
Sure.
What do you think is the big difference between the Orvis, say that old one you're talking about, the impregnated, and the current Orvis? Because I think the new rods, they cost more, right, than what you're selling?
They do, yeah. The new Orvis bamboos are quite expensive. The impregnation process is different. They're still doing an impregnated finish, but it's a different one. And I think that the older rods, the cane quality is probably a little bit better than what's currently available. And the tapers that Wes Jordan designed for those early two-piece Orvises are pretty distinct. So you've got a different rod, but it's certainly a very good rod. The quality of workmanship is very good, but different feel than the earlier Orvises would have.
Yeah. Okay. So I'm just trying to get in a feel. It's cool. You know, you mentioned the person from Japan, because you get a feel for why these people are interested. What would be, can you give us another example of another client you've had and maybe another story of what they purchased?
I'm trying to think of rods that I've sold recently. This last week,
or maybe I'm thinking rods or reels.
Yeah. And I haven't sold any to people that I know as well as I do know this guy. I have a client right now who's, as I said, chasing Bob Taylor rods. I've sold him a couple of rods over the years, and he's a guy from the East Coast. And as I say, there's a little Bob Taylor enthusiasm burning back there, kind of a brush fire. He's a guy who probably fishes four or five very high quality rods. He's in Pennsylvania, so he's fishing the small, slow streams that they have there, requiring very delicate presentations. I imagine that he rarely fishes a fly under a number 20. He fishes a lot of terrestrials. They have exotic patterns imitating beetles and all kinds of terrestrial insects that you wouldn't associate with the water. And they have a lot of continuity among groups. They're very big on clubs, and so many of the clubs own their own water there. So it's kind of a different ambiance than we're accustomed to here on the West Coast, where everyone tends to sort of go their own way, and it requires different kinds of equipment, and certainly a lot of different techniques in their dry fly fishing. I'm not sure if that answered your question very well, Dave.
I think I was just trying to get at the point of, you know, why, you know, who those people are, and I just think of myself, this might be a good example if I had to say, I don't have really any, I have some classic rods, but I don't have any bamboo, but my dad does. And I kind of think about, I could see that if, you know, I was using his rod and, you know, I was like, well, this is, you know, had that experience. I'm like, this would be cool to, I could see myself digging into it. And you hear, you know, obviously bamboo, is a popular topic out there. So
sure,
that would make sense to me. So maybe I'll be a client of yours in the future as we go. Good. Here.
We can do that.
So if somebody was coming, somebody brand new, somebody's listening right now, and they want to get a rod, so they don't know anything. They've got some basic graphite rods, but they'd love to. They're loving this story about connecting to some cool rods. Where do they start to learn about, you know, maybe they don't know anything about these classic rods. Where would you send them to actually learn about what they might get if it's, say, they want to go trout fishing?
Well, there are a lot of books out, and I'm sort of a book guy myself, so I would suggest, starting there. There isn't a publication that is particularly helpful in terms of a magazine or something like that. There is a very good website, though, the forum, as we call it, the Classic Fly Rod Forum, which has a lot of interaction among members about bamboo rods and other things, all kinds of things. So that's a good place to sort of nose around. As far as what kind of a rod to buy, it's almost axiomatic that whatever you buy, you're going to want something different in 6 months after you get familiar with it. So I usually tell people that, you know, they want to start out with a rod that is going to be a sort of general purpose rod, and it's also going to be one that is going to be easily resold when they're moving on to something else. Probably the Orbis two-piece bat and kill, 7.5 foot, 3 7/8 ounces is, you know, absolutely a crowd pleaser. There's always a market for those rods. They're very, very durable. Nothing much goes wrong with them. The Orbis ferrules are great. They're fun rods. They're easy to cast. They're comfortable. They're a nice transition, I think, from graphite. Probably aren't too many people who are fishing fiberglass right now, except the fiberglass enthusiasts. And the movement from graphite to an Orvis bat and kill is a pretty easy one. So I would sort of suggest moving in that direction. Also, when you get tired of your Orbis, if you do, it's easy to resell. There's always a strong demand for them.
Perfect. Perfect. So that gives us a good start. So the bat and kill is a good one. And what would that be, you know, getting into that? Just gives a like a rough idea of cost to get pick up a rod. And are we talking bamboo or no?
Yeah, nice bat and kill, which is the two-tip rod, is going to run you about $650. The one-tip version of the bat and kill is called a Madison, and that's going to be about $100, $150 less. There are also some other Orbises that are good, but the bat and kill is probably your best choice.
The best choice. And is that now a bamboo or graphite?
That's bamboo, and it's impregnated. Most of the rods that people like in that category were made in the 60s, 70s, and 80s, and that's, you know, 30-year span, so there are quite a few rods cranked out during those years.
Perfect. No, this is great. I love the bat and kill. So if I wanted to pick that up today, and that's totally reasonable, I mean, literally you can get $500, get a cool classic rod. Could you go to your site? I mean, is your site set up for actually purchasing, or is it more like they send an email to you?
No. Well, I learned very soon that it's very good to talk to clients before they make a purchase. Make certain that it's going to be a comfortable purchase for them. And I don't want to be in the shopping cart mode in which people buy something and get it and think, holy cow, you know, I ordered that online after I'd had 4 martinis, and that may not have been a good choice for me.
That's right.
I want to have a chance to get to know my clients and make certain that they're making a good choice. So yeah, I'll be happy to sell you one, but you got to call me up or send me a text or write me an email, and then we'll put the deal together.
Yeah, I like that. I like that. That's cool. And then that bat and kill would be a great rod, like you said, for trout. What would be a good reel? So you said the Hardy. What would balance up with that if you're going to grab a 5-weight bat and kill?
Well, we've talked about the Hardy Perfect, which is always a good reel. In the late 1950s, Hardy came out with what they call the lightweight series. And these were lighter in weight, obviously, than the earlier reels, either the St. George or the Perfect. And they have stayed in production for a long time, and they've been a very successful reel. I sell a lot of them. I like them. The LRH is the 5-weight. The featherweight is the 4-weight. And they have a Princess, which is a good 6-weight reel. And so all of the lightweight series reels are very similar in design. They have a lot of things going for them. They're easy to shift from right-hand wind to left-hand wind. The spools are interchangeable with complete confidence, unlike the Perfects, where you sometimes have to scratch your head and they still don't fit. And, I think they're great reels. And again, they're reels that everybody knows and everybody likes. So if you get tired of it, you can get rid of it. And I would probably, with that rod, I would probably grab a lightweight. If I were fishing 5-weight, I would probably grab an LRH. Those are the initials of Lawrence Hardy, who was a head of the company for many years. If I were fishing a 6, I would probably grab a Princess. And being someone who likes gear, I would have both reels with a couple of lines for each, multiple spools, so that if I'm fishing in the Deschutes and it's getting windy at 4 o'clock in the afternoon, I can shift over to 6-weight and punch it out. And if I'm fishing something delicate early in the morning with PMDs, I could use a 5-weight double taper and make a more genteel presentation. And I think it would be a very versatile and useful outfit.
Yeah, no, it sounds awesome. I think, like you said, $500 for a cool classic rod. And what is that Hardy lightweight? What's that going to run you?
They sell, depending on the condition, they sell in the neighborhood from $200 to about $300. So they're not an expensive reel. And by condition, I don't mean anything mechanical. There's really nothing mechanical that goes wrong with them. You can get they have a duplicated check system. So if you break your check or break a spring, you've got an extra one in the reel ready to go in about 2 seconds. You might get some finish wear, which isn't going to make any difference. You might get a little bit of corrosion on the aluminum parts, which you can clean up. But, you know, as long as the reel works, there's nothing going to happen to it. So I don't think condition is a big issue with the lightweights.
Okay, cool. Now this is great. So we got a rod reel. I'm curious. I want to dig a little bit more into some of the reels, and we'll talk on fly boxes before we get out of here. But I'm curious on your gear. So if a couple things. So if somebody has gear, maybe they want to, you know, sell, get rid of, and also where do you get your gear? So typically you've got all this gear, it sounds like, on your website. Where do you find all this stuff?
Well, I go to shows before the virus. I typically did the show in Somerset, New Jersey, and I usually do the show in Daytona, Florida in the winter. On the West Coast, we have the Santa Rosa show, which is in early March. Here in Oregon, we have the Northwest NFLCC shows, which were formerly held in Kelso, Washington. There are two of those a year. I do a lot of the states, and basically, when you've been in the business for a while, estate attorneys get your name, put it in the Rolodex, and when they get an estate and some guy's got a basement full of fishing tackle, you get a call. So that's kind of exciting. You never know what you're going to find.
How often does that happen? Do you get calls?
If I get two or three decent estates in a year, that's probably pretty good. Sometimes you get a very large estate that's from a collector or a person who does some serious acquisition. Sometimes, you know, we just get some of the fishing items from another estate. We recently got through auction an estate of the person who was the CEO of the Garcia company for many years in the U.S. And he was able to afford some very nice reels. So we were happy to get those.
So you go in there and you just basically just give them a price and they take the price and then you kind of go with it.
We give them a price and we hope they take the price.
That's right. Well, you're the expert. So how could they, it'd be hard to debate with you on cost because you kind of know what it all costs, right?
Uh, Well, I have a pretty good idea of it. But, you know, everyone asks me what something is worth. And I, you know, I don't know what anything is worth, but I do know what things cost. So I try to do that. A lot of times, though, what you're trying to do in an estate situation is, you know, give people an idea if they don't know anything about fishing, what might be appropriate for them to keep. A lot of times they want to have some kind of a keepsake of a member of the family, and a reel or a rod, you know, is a good thing to hang on to. And so we can help with that. And, you know, we can also work around comparable values. It's relatively easy now with stuff on the internet to, you know, just basically crank out a list and say, here's what this kind of a reel, this kind of condition has been selling for in the last 10 years. And here it is in black and white. And we like to do that because it, you know, it makes things easier. Estates are good because, you know, everyone gets some, people get some resolution, get things sorted out. And usually they're happy at the end of it. And we know oftentimes people will hold something back and they think, well, I'm going to keep this wonderful reel. And then a year later, they're tired of tripping over it. And it comes back to me. So that's a very important part of what we do.
Gotcha. How many other websites out there? It sounds like you've had your site around for a long time, but are there a number of other classic type websites doing the similar thing?
Yeah, there are, you know, more than 10 and less than 20. And the guys who've been around as long as I have, we all know each other and, you know, usually meet at shows and conventions. And there are probably, you know, maybe 15 of us, I would say. And that, you know, and given the nature of the web, there can be, you know, five can crop up like mushrooms after a rainstorm. But yeah. As far as continuity, and the guys who have been at it the longest, like Jim Adams in Berkeley, have a, you know, huge following of people and lots of access to stuff. So we go back and forth. And, you know, we all, as I say, we all sort of know each other.
Gotcha. Who was, I haven't heard Jim Adams, who was, what's his story? Has he just been doing this a little bit longer than you, what you've been doing?
Yes, he has been. Jim is one of the, he was a book dealer. Jim was a fisheries biologist. He had a long career in California and Alaska in salmon and trout management. He retired to Berkeley. He has a very strong book business. He also is a longtime Hardy dealer, and he has an intimate knowledge of Hardy rods and reels, and I frequently ask him questions. Jim and I have known each other and gone back and forth and done business for over 20 years. He's a great guy. He fishes a lot. He fishes Russia. He fishes Quebec. He fishes the Skeena drainage in Canada. He also fishes tarpon in Florida in the wintertime. And he lives a very good life.
Yeah, that's pretty cool.
Yeah.
And you said there's a few other, like 10 other people doing a similar thing in just different levels all around the country?
Yeah, that's probably a good number. Yeah.
Okay. All right, perfect. Anything else to know about, you know, as we start to think about taking this out as, you know, from a perspective of rods, reels, other gear, stuff, you know, if somebody was coming in, they wanted to pick up a setup, kind of like we're talking, maybe a rod or a reel, anything else you would tell them to get prepared?
Always a good idea to cast a rod before you buy it. You want to make certain that if you don't like it, if something goes wrong, you can return it. And that's really important. And, I think that, you know, the general sort of due diligence on the buyer's part is key. So if you buy a rod from a fly shop, you know that if something goes wrong, you can go back and holler and they'll probably respond. If you're buying something on the secondary market, it may not be quite that easy. So going with an established dealer is a good idea because those people, myself included, are concerned about reputation, and that's a big part of what we do. But beyond that, you know, I think that with, especially in the secondary market, talk to the seller before you make a decision. You know, while we've been talking on the phone here, I've had two calls from people who want something, and I'm going to, you know, talk to them and see what they want, if I've got it, and it's going to work out. And, you know, that's easy. But if they want to go saltwater fishing and they want to buy a hardy reel, that's not going to work out too well, because those reels don't do well in saltwater. That may not be something that they know. And, you know, and so I think that communication is kind of critical.
What are the, when you call back on that phone, what are the, you know, are there a couple of questions that you always ask to get to feel, or is it always different? Is every call different?
Well, if it's a, you know, if it's a customer that I, a client that I don't know, you know, I try to find out a little bit and not be nosy, but just, you know, find out what their comfort level is and what kind of fishing they do. If it's a client that I know, I mean, you know, those guys are usually two jumps ahead of me. So I just, you know, shut up and run the Visa card.
Right. It sounds pretty cool, because I guess I was coming into this thinking, you know, stuff was going to be really a lot more high, you know, more expensive stuff. But it sounds like you can get some really high quality classic gear and even vintage for, you know, like $1,000 or definitely under $2,000.
Sure.
Yeah. So it sounds like it's pretty reasonable. I mean, I would imagine, you know, these people that are calling, I'm not sure what they're looking for, but it sounds like, you know, I mean, when you get these people to call, what percentage of those people are, you know, how many people do you have to go through that to make a sale there? Do you find it's more like half of those people, or you have to weed through a lot of people to find people that actually are a good fit?
It's usually, you know, pretty quick. And most times, you know, people that have gone to the effort of contacting me are pretty serious about it. So I don't get, you know, I don't get a lot of people who are just sort of want to chew the fat, although I do get some. That's fine. I enjoy that. It's a, you know, inexpensive entertainment. At shows is a different story. You get guys walking by looking at your stuff at the table, and, you know, that's not really the same kind of thing that we're talking about from the online sales. So I do get people who are interested in something which I may not have, and that's, you know, that's always kind of frustrating, because a lot of times I've had the item and it's sold, or I think I know where one might be available, but right. I don't have it in hand, and you know, but that's perfectly legitimate. I mean, that's the kind of thing that I really encourage, because you know, I want people to know what they want and to find out, you know, how they can get it. So that's the kind of thing that I think produces good, happy clients. And we try to do that.
I think I saw a story on Sage. Do you see a lot of Sage rods, classic rods coming through?
Yeah, I like Sage, and I fish Sage myself. And the graphite is... there are an awful lot of models out there. Sage cranks out a new model every year, at least one, and sometimes more than one. And some of those have a kind of niche following. In other words, people like them, they can't get them anymore, and they're always after them. And I understand that. And I don't do a lot with graphite as far as sales go. But I think that, you know, 20 years from now, people are going to look back at certain graphite rods, which will be in that category, you know, of classic tackle, ones that have proven to be good over the years and that have given a lot of people a lot of satisfaction in their fishing.
Do you have a Sage? I'm curious if there's, you know, as far as a story about kind of a, you mentioned the lantern, some of that. Is there another good story you could leave us with here as far as like a company or a company you deal with a lot, kind of some old classic gear story?
With Sage?
Yeah, I thought I might have saw an article I believe you wrote out there on a website. Maybe I might be off, though. I thought it was on Sage, on like the history of Sage or something like that.
No, I'm not the person. There's a wonderful book on fiberglass rods by Vic Johnson, which is called something like Fiberglass Rods. It's a pretty obvious title. And he and his father were both engineers and both very, very interested in fiberglass rods, among other things, and did an awfully good job of researching the growth and development of the fiberglass stuff. I deal a lot with Russ Peak rods. He was a fiberglass maker in Pasadena, California, and he produced some excellent rods. The workmanship was superb. He was a bamboo maker who got into fiberglass early on, and really neat stuff. Another early fiberglass maker was Ferdinand Claudio, who was in San Francisco. Much less production than Russ Peak, but again, amazing attention to detail. He got the basically made the blanks himself on another company's equipment. Those early fiberglass rods, Vince Cummings is another name. Those are wonderful pieces, and there's a strong market for them. And I think that that's something that you might find in a garage sale and well worth looking for.
That's right. Have you seen a little rebound of fiberglass recently? It sounds like.
You bet. Absolutely. Yeah. Yes, absolutely. And some of the makers are getting back into fiberglass. Hardy has a series out called the Perfection Fiberglass Rods. Wonderful rods. And they, you know, they cast like a dream. They look great. They've taken a lot of time and care in putting them together. They're basically handmade, although of course the blanks are made on the machinery, but the fitting out of the rod and the, they use a ferrule system called the tip-over ferrules, which are later, but very nice, and just very, very attractive rods. Strong market for them.
There you go. So getting back to your website, so you have, you know, rods, reels. If somebody's to go there, would you just recommend, it sounds like just grabbing your phone number and giving you a call if they have questions is the best place. Is there a...
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
Perfect. Okay. Good. Well, I think I have a good feel for maybe a rod and a reel. I was kind of curious, you steelhead, I mentioned the Rivermaster. That was a kind of an old Orvis graphite rod that was pretty popular as a, like steelhead rod, especially back in the day. It was kind of cool, you know, kind of a newly rod or whatever. But do you get many people coming in looking for steelhead gear?
Yeah, I do. In the classic stuff, I sell the Powell rods, which are really closely associated with West Coast steelheading. Those were bamboo. I also sell some other rods that have those associations, Winston mostly, but not much beyond that. Steelhead reels, again, there are some that had strong associations. The White School Hardys were a big deal. The Thompson, which was the American version of the Hardy Perfect, a wonderful reel and highly demanding in terms of keeping it in tune and working, but wonderful reels. Yeah, I like those a lot. Yeah, so yeah, there's that gear out there. And there's after the publication of some books and the film in recent years, there's been a lot of interest in the sort of 50s and 60s on the rivers in Northern California and Southern Oregon.
Yeah. And the Thompson was, so that reel, so you said it looks a little like the Hardy, but it's a little bit more finicky.
Yeah. It's a, mechanically it's a dead ringer for the Hardy Perfect. It's a winding plate reel, but it's got a very complicated check system. It's got a check and a brake, both of which are adjustable. And the making the reel bankrupted about three companies. So the putting the reels together, you would think something as simple as a fly reel would be a snap, but it basically requires hours of bench time to get the things working right. And but once they're set up, you know, they work very well. So there were two sizes of them, a wide spool for steelhead and a narrow spool for trout. And they're great reels. They're very durable, good finish. Mechanically, they're excellent. Of course, they haven't been made for about 50 years, so it's hard to get parts for them. But they're great reels. Everyone needs one.
Oh, right. So the Thompson, you would recommend. That's a good reel. That'd be a cool reel to have.
I think it's a great reel to have. It may not be the reel you want to fish with, but it's just fun to tinker with, you know.
That's great. Maybe that Thompson would meet up with the Rivermaster I'm thinking of to get an old classic.
I'm certain it would. It sounds like a marriage made in heaven there.
There you go. There you go. All right. I'll have to check back on that. And what about, we mentioned a few common questions. Are there a couple of common questions you get, you know, you could expect you might get from these calls today or when people call in?
Most of the questions and most of the interest involves, you know, the condition of an item. So people will be concerned about, you know, what might be wrong with something that they're thinking about buying. And that's easy to talk about. What I like to do with a client is, you know, be sitting here at my desk with a rod or reel in my lap so that I can go through it and, you know, be responsive to any concerns. I think that with the more complicated saltwater fly reels, there's concern oftentimes about getting parts. One of the things that I often, if the answer is changing from right hand to left hand and vice versa. And there's some reels that are, you know, they're set up to do that. It's relatively easy. There are others that you can do it, but it's going to require some head scratching. And there are some that you're better off to send to Archuleta, Bill Archuleta, who's a famous reel mechanic, and let him do it. You know, there's that concern, and it's completely legitimate.
Yeah, that's great. So there's definitely some resources out there, and maybe if people have questions, we could direct them to you, you know, whether they want new gear or have a question about, you know, maybe what their gear's worth or they could sell. But it sounded like you mentioned that that resource as far as the forum. There's probably some Facebook groups out there, I'd imagine, that are also probably good resources.
Yeah, I'm certain that there are. And, you know, you can kind of root around in the internet and see what might work for you.
Okay. Perfect, Ward. Well, one last one for you. I'm just curious, you know, you've been going, like, how long is this website? Like 25 years?
Yeah, we've been out there for quite a while.
Yeah, so like the mid-90s. So what's, I mean, all this time, I'm just curious, you know, what, I'd imagine it sounds like you have a good passion for this stuff, but what's kept you going? Why haven't you, you know, thrown in the towel and moved on? What's like got you still going on this?
Well, it started as a, you know, as a co-op. There were, I think, five of us originally, and we all had stuff. And as I say, my daughter took a high school class in making websites, and she was excited about that. And you know, it was easy when we started, and also operating a website was a lot easier then. And, you know, as those original five guys have gotten old and, you know, diminished, we all have, and then I retired and have more time to do it. So I enjoy the stuff, and I'm always learning things, and I like, you know, getting something that I haven't seen before and taking it apart. You know, it's a completely harmless hobby. The fish may not see it as harmless, but, you know, that's not my problem.
There you go. So do you still love it? Kind of, you get a new piece of gear or something in there, kind of like you did 20 years ago, still kind of that excitement?
I tell you something, a couple of weeks ago, we had an NFLCC conference in Portland. A guy that I'd done business with for many, many years had a fly box for me with some Irish Atlantic salmon flies tied in the 1890s.
Oh, wow.
And I was, you know, I was ecstatic.
No kidding.
My wife heard about it until she was rolling her eyes. So it was great. And I was able to get it. And, you know, that's the kind of thing that keeps you motivated.
Wow, that's cool. And it's, what kind of fly box was it in?
It's a Wheatley, but it was a very rare 8-inch Wheatley. You sort of never see them. And they were, I think they were used more in Europe than they were over here, although there were some of them that were sold in the U.S. Through Abercrombie and Fitch. And the flies were in great shape. They were tied with feathers that the birds are long extinct. The tire was extremely good. Not all of the flies in the box were from the same hand, but probably 70% of them were from the same hand. And it was a wonderful selection of flies.
Did you know who they were from? Which hand? Who tied them?
No, I do not know who the tire was, and the period, there's some other newer flies mixed in, but the period is a little bit vague. It's probably the 1890s, judging from the hooks, which are kind of the easiest to date. But anyhow, that's the kind of thing that, you know, that keeps you going. You never know when you're going to stumble across something like that.
No, that's really cool. Well, I think that's a perfect story to leave us out of here on this one. And yeah, just give a heads up what you have going the next year. Anything new, or are you just going to keep moving along with new gear coming in, or anything you want to give a shout out?
No, nice stuff coming in. Took in a nice collection from back in Connecticut. And we also were able to buy, I think I mentioned, the reels from the former CEO of the Garcia Corporation.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. He spent a lot of money on reels, as you can imagine. And yes. So those are going to be fun. And I'm looking forward to being able to travel more as the virus diminishes. And we're getting set up for our trip to southeastern Alaska, which we do every year. In fact, I'm going to continue with that today. So, you know, lots going on.
Is that steelhead trip, or what do you got? What's that for?
No, we've fished Pacific salmon in the salt, which is a frustrating thing to do, but I enjoy it. And so we'll be fishing out of Craig and then out of Clover Pass.
There you go. There you go. And will you be fishing a classic gear for that trip?
For that trip, I will be using graphite, and it will be sage rods, I believe, probably a TNT 8-weight that I've been kind of liking recently.
And would this be considered classic or no?
No, it's contemporary stuff.
You're not messing with the big fish.
Yeah, I fish a Finnor in salt water. I fish a Finnor anti-reverse. I use it in the tropics and in Alaska. It's not the most delicate nor the most trendy reel, and some of my associates make fun of it, but I like it, and it saves my knuckles. And I've been at it for a long time with that reel.
That's awesome. Or let's go just for we get out here a couple more minutes, because I'm interested in the Finnor. That reel, can you give us a little background on that, why that reel? Because it has an anti-reverse, so it doesn't, when they strip out line, it doesn't spin the spool or the reel handle.
No. Finnor was one of the first people in saltwater fly fishing, and their wedding cake was a very famous reel. The anti-reverse was the second reel that they developed after the wedding cake. They're not as highly prized. It's about a $250 reel these days, but they're extremely durable. Their finish is, the anodized finish is really, really impervious to salt water. Mine looks great, and I've used it probably for 10 years, both in Central America and in Mexico and in Alaska. And you can't say that for very many anodized finishes. It's also mechanically great. When you're fishing from a skiff, I think that having an anti-reverse is advantageous. And so that's why I do it. But again, there's a huge amount of debate about that. And if fly fishermen were ever asked to form a firing squad, it would be in the form of a circle.
Yeah. Well, what's the, the anti-reverse to me seems like a great idea. Like your reel's not spinning. You can't whack your knuckles. Why do people not like anti-reverse? Right? Because there's almost no reels are anti-reverse, right?
Right. Very few fly reels are. It's one more thing. And mechanically, there's always a concern that something is going to go wrong at an inopportune time.
All right.
Which is a real possibility. They tend to be a little bit heavier. So, there are all kinds of things that people don't like about them. But for the most part, with heavy-duty saltwater reels, you're going to have to play that drag all the time because you're stripping with the drag off, and then you're fishing with the drag on. And so I don't find that a problem. But as I say, when I'm fishing from a skiff for Pacific salmon, I like the anti-reverse, and there it is.
That's perfect. All right, Ward, I'll send everybody out to classic flyfishingtackle.com. And just wanted to say thanks for coming on and sharing some wisdom here. This has given us a good start, and hopefully we'll connect you with some listeners to the show. Thanks again, Ward.
Thank you, Dave. I appreciate it, and good luck.
So there you go. If you want to find all the show notes, all the links, everything else we covered today, head over to wetflyswing.com/276. 276 will get you the links, get you the good stuff that we talked about today. And maybe there's a random YouTube video over there as well that we just tucked in. I'll have to make sure to add something, or Domingo. Maybe Domingo can fire this up and add a cool video or a music video that he likes. We'll see what we can do there. Please click that subscribe button if you haven't already. If you're on Apple Podcasts, that's a follow, that plus sign in the upper right corner, and you'll get updated when our next episode goes live. And I'm not exactly sure what that is right now, but I know it's going to be amazing. We'd love to hear from you. If you get a chance, send me an email, dave@wetflyswing.com, and just take one moment right now and just let me know. I'd love to hear if you're listening, where you're from, what's happening out there. And just, if nothing else, just say hi, let me know you're listening. It helps me tremendously to keep going strong, even when we're busting out two episodes a week. Sometimes not always easy to do. So I'd love to hear from you just to give me a heads up. And yeah, the bonus would be if you have an episode or a topic you'd love me to dig into deeper, I would also love to hook that up for you. I wanted to say thank you again. I appreciate you for being a listener and listening into this one to the very end. And I really hope to catch up with you online or maybe on the river.
Thanks for listening to the Wet Fly Swing Fly Fishing Show. For notes and links from this episode, visit wetflyswing.com.